Very pleased to be with you this afternoon. You know, as I was getting ready for the talk here just this morning, as probably most priests can attest, we tend to be getting ready for speeches and things like that quite relatively soon before them sometimes. But, you know, I was reflecting on the universality of the church. It really struck me the last 24 hours as the priests were coming in. We were standing there. We got Father Krzysztof's here from Russia, and he's talking about his missions in Asia. And Bishop Espina here from Argentina, myself and Bishop Roth from Canada, and men of such diverse personality and background and culture and preferences, you would never find them as friends, necessarily, unless it was for the faith. And yet they're so united in working for that Catholic faith. It's a really wonderful thing to see. It's that universal religion, that God is our Father, and we share that one Catholic faith. And it's a neat thing to see across the borders. So with that said, I want to talk to you about a little bit today about some of the history of the Catholic Church in Canada, and in particular of some of the martyrs. And we'll be speaking of some of the martyrs who died in the U.S. as well, who were killed in the U.S. as well, because they all kind of go together. So as Father mentioned, I'm from Canada. I know you weren't really sure how to react to that, but that's okay. Because you know Canada has something unique about it. We're the one country in the world that doesn't want to be American, I think. Yeah? So, yeah. I was planning to get a map to show you where I'm from that said America and non-America. You know? But we have a lot of great American friends, really good relationship to there. Someone, if I meet somebody, they say, oh, I'm related to someone from Canada. Say, are you from Michigan? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we're going to show you kind of where we're from here. So depending on your geography, interestingly, where I'm from in Canada is about 315 miles south of where we are today. So when most people think of Canada, they think of north. We had some girls come to Ontario one time for a girls' camp. Some of the sisters here might remember that. It was years and years ago. And they brought their winter clothes. And it was the summertime. They only traveled straight east. They didn't even go north. So we have a map here. We'll switch here. I looked up the traffic in 1642, and there wasn't anything to display. So but we'll get our pointer out here. So I'm from the Great Lakes region here. Really, really beautiful place. It's distinguished by, you know, we have the largest reserve of liquid fresh water in the world. And so I'm from right about here, London, Ontario. And so almost four directions I go, we hit the Great Lakes. And water was a very prominent part of the early missionary journeys. In this region of the world, it was the primary method of transportation, was the canoe in this part of the country. So many of you may be familiar with Detroit. So here's just as a point of reference, Detroit here. If you travel up about 2.5 hours, you get to our parish here in London. And then if you head a little further north, travel up here, this is called Georgian Bay. Right on the southern tip of Georgian Bay, we find Midland, Ontario. And in Midland, Ontario, there's Martyr's Shrine. And you can go to the place where the martyrs were martyred. And it's something really unique and really special. You know, one thing I think, we have a tendency to think of saints and sanctity as something kind of exotic or legendary or, you know, in the past, something far away from us. But we can go in our own continent and stand on the place where they became saints. They died and their souls went to heaven and that very spot. And so, you know, how quickly we think what it would be like to go to Rome and see the ground where the martyrs shed their blood, we have that right here in North America. And so we also have great saints in heaven. So we're going to talk about the brutal torture and martyrdom that the saints underwent a little bit later on here. So first of all, a little bit more history. So the age of the explorers, in the time of the explorers, it was the French Catholics who first came to Canada. The famous explorer Jacques Cartier came in the 1530s, and on his first trip to Canada. Now, I didn't quite get all of North America here, but here you see the St. Lawrence River, which figures very prominently because when they first found it, they thought, oh, here's the route to east that we're looking for because it's so large. But over in eastern Canada here, Jacques Cartier, on his second voyage, would erect a 30-foot cross before returning to France. And the first permanent French settlement in Canada would be made under Samuel de Champlain. Champlain was a devout Catholic. He was the first governor of New France, as it was then called, if I recall correctly. And with him, the history of Canada really starts. He founded the first permanent settlement in Canada in 1608, and that is the city of Quebec. And interestingly, today, the city of Quebec is one of our prominent missions, as you'll probably hear a little on, later on from Bishop Waugh, one of our prominent missions here. So Quebec did not quite make the map either. I wasn't thinking of that when I cropped it, but Quebec is right about here on the north shore of the St. Lawrence River. So as we're saying, and so the explorers came down as far as Montreal as well. Montreal, as an indicator of the Catholic history, was actually originally called the City of Mary. And so the name later changed to Montreal. Now this is just to give you an idea. The picture you saw at the very start before I started speaking wasn't just random woods and trees and so forth. It's the area where the martyrs were killed. And this is the site. Now it's just a little alcove of grassland cut out. But this is the site where Saint Jean de Brebeuf and Saint Gregory Lalemant were martyred. And we'll tell you about their martyrdom in a little bit. But they have a cross erected there, and there's a small outdoor stone altar and a historical plaque there that tells you about their martyrdom. And that is their graves where they were buried. There used to be a more permanent grave. Their bodies have obviously been exhumed, and their relics, much to my bitterness, the relics are in France, most of them. I thought, as if France didn't have enough saint relics, they had to take ours too. So if anyone I know ever becomes Pope, I want the relics back. Otherwise, we're going to have to kill somebody else. Okay, here's a statue of Champlain here. So very, very prominent figure in our history. Okay, the North American martyrs. We're going to tell you a little bit about their martyrdom. This image here has an interesting recent history. So at the Shrine of the North American Martyrs, this image, when I was growing up, it was in the middle. You know, if you went to the church, it was what you saw, front and center, where the main altar would have been before the Novus Ordo. And it was also about 25% longer than what it is now, than what you see now. And I tried quickly yesterday to find the original image. I can't find it. The original image shows underneath this the martyrdom of all the martyrs. It has a scene showing their martyrdom, but that has been covered up because it's not politically correct. I think they've moved the image to the side of the church, and I think they just covered it. I don't think they cut it. But I was looking at it, and one of the sisters indicated that there was perhaps a lawsuit threatening to sue them for this image showing by some of the local tribes showing the martyrdom. So I guess in the Novus Ordo, we know they're in heaven, but we're not sure how. Actually, it's pretty funny. So pretty funny. One of the, there's a subdeacon who works with me in Ontario, Reverend St. Aubin, and he is a historian by profession before entering the seminary as a degree in history. And he was researching to teach the kids history. And he said one of the Protestant or secular books he was reading, trying to find a good history book to use, it said Saint Jean de Brebeuf, came to Canada, and he tried to convince the Indians his religion was right, and then he died. And that was it. So who knows how or why. Saint René Goupil was the first of the martyrs to be killed. And he was 35 years old, and he was a lay brother. Two of the martyrs, there are 8 North American martyrs, two of them were lay brothers. So he was martyred by tomahawk, which was a blunt weapon that was used by the Indians. And that was September 29th, 1642. So you might be familiar with that date. We just had the Feast of the North American Martyrs. Interestingly, we call it the Feast of the North American Martyrs in the Missal in the United States. It's called Saint Isaac Jogues, Jean de Brebeuf and Companions. But in Canada, the feast day is Saint Jean de Brebeuf, Isaac Jogues and Companions, because of which soil they were martyred on. Saint Isaac Jogues in New York State, Saint Jean de Brebeuf in what's now Ontario. And so Saint René Goupil, as we said, he was martyred on September 29th. He had made the sign of the cross on the forehead of some children. And that was what what prompted or brought about his martyrdom, or was the catalyst, I guess you could say, for his martyrdom. And his martyrdom, as mentioned, he was martyred in present-day New York State, as were St. Isaac Joe's and St. Jean de Lalande. He was captured by the Iroquois with Father Jogues, and he suffered his fingers to be bitten off and other tortures. And he always tried to convert his enemies, an example of love of enemies to the end. St. Isaac Jogues figures prominently, as I mentioned. His name holds the first place in the liturgy in the United States. And he was a priest a little older, 39, and he became a prisoner of the Mohawk Indians. So in our area, there's what's called the Six Nations, I believe it is. There was the Iroquois Confederacy, which was a confederacy of a group of Indians. And amongst them, the Mohawks were one of those. And there was a great conflict or a great enmity between the Iroquois, including the Mohawks, and the Huron people. And the Huron were those, and there's another name by which they're more properly known by, but the Huron were those who were St. Jean de Beauboeuf was working amongst at the time of his death. And so the conflict between the Huron and the Iroquois figured prominently in the death of the martyrs, because it was often in the context of that war between. So St. Isaac, he became a prisoner of the Mohawks, and he was, this first time he became prisoner, he was assisted by the Dutch, actually, in New Amsterdam, the New York area there, to escape back to England, but only after his fingers had been mutilated. And when he arrived back in Europe, he was not allowed to say Mass because he didn't have the proper fingers to be able to say Mass. However, Pope Urban VIII granted him special permission to do so, saying it would be unjust that a martyr for Christ should not drink the blood of Christ. And he returned, but again, after all that, he returned to North America, and he also died by tomahawk after being treacherously invited to a meal. His head was cut off. There's some gruesome details in here, but his head was cut off and placed on a pole facing the route by which he had come to the town. And interestingly, the same town where he was killed, 10 years later, Venerable Kateri Tekakwitha was born in that town. She was called the Lily of the Mohawks, and she was declared venerable by Pope Pius XII. I have a couple slides here, a couple images of St. Isaac Jogues. St. Jean de Lalande was a skilled trapper who lived in New France with the missionaries, so it's kind of like a lay brother. And he was also tomahawked and beheaded the day after St. Isaac. And you can imagine the great help that the brothers were to the priests at that time, all the traveling and everything. You think about the many details that go into missionary life. You know, I think about sometimes too, I'm sure my brother priests can empathize. You're going on the plane, you think, okay, I got to take wine. I don't want to put it in the carry-on, or don't put it on the check luggage because it might get smashed. And the carry-on, I have to put it in, you know, less than 100 milliliter or whatever it is now, says containers, and so troubles. But imagine them. You got to carry your wine with you through the forest and wherever you're traveling to. So a lot of the difficulties. St. Anthony Daniel was killed by arrows in the Iroquois attack on the 4th of July. His body was burned with his church. So after he had courageously baptized and strengthened many of his people, as their death approached, he was shot with arrows. His body was thrown into the church and it was lit on fire. And as I was discussing, preparing for this, someone was mentioning to me that he had already been shot and that he heard someone calling out for baptism. So he dragged himself over and baptized them. And that's how he died. He was baptizing someone in his death. And something interesting about that, I think, is that it shows the great faith that they had in the sacraments. You know, they didn't just say, oh, he'll be all right. They went to great lengths to provide people with the sacraments because they were there for the salvation of their souls. He worked 14 years alongside of Father St. Jean de Beauboeuf, and a few days before his death, the two priests made their monthly retreat together at Fort St. Marie. We're going to see some pictures of Fort St. Marie later on, depending how our time goes. I'm just giving you kind of a brief picture, a brief summary of all of them. St. Jean de Beauboeuf. St. Jean de Beauboeuf figures the most prominently among the North American martyrs. And St. Jean de Beauboeuf and St. Gregory Lalemant were killed side by side. They were, after being taken prisoner And so they were functioning around St. Marie among the Hurons, the village they had established in Midland, Ontario, where I was pointing out to you earlier. And just a few miles from there, there's a mission called St. Ignace II. There was a St. Ignace I, this was St. Ignace II. And it was at that small mission location that they were executed, taken prisoner, and so forth. So they suffered very severe tortures. They were stripped and beaten with sticks on every part of their bodies, after which St. John de Brebeuf continued to exhort and encourage the nearby Christians. Then red-hot steel was applied to their bodies, including a necklace of heated lance blades. So you can imagine they took the lance heads, heated them red-hot in the fire, strung them together, and hung it around their neck on their bare skin like a necklace. One of the priests had his hands cut off. Their waists were circled with flammable bark, you know, the pitch in the bark, and they were set aflame. Father Lalemant prayed, and St. John de Brebeuf preached to his persecutors and encouraged the Christian captives until he was gagged, his nose was cut off, his lips were torn off, and then in mockery of baptism, they soaked the priests in boiling water in mockery of baptism. Finally, their hearts were removed before their death, and having observed the tremendous courage that St. John de Brebeuf showed under his sufferings, the Indians really admired it. They were really impressed by it. And so his heart was actually eaten because of the great courage that he exemplified. So really tremendous suffering that these men underwent. And right up to the end, concerned again with the salvation of souls, preaching to their captors, encouraging their faithful. They were there because they wanted people to get to heaven. They wanted people to have the faith and get to heaven. So he spent his first winter in Canada with the Algonquin tribe, and life in the longhouses was very hard. So the longhouse environment, you know, we may see a picture a little later on of the longhouses, but they talk about how in the wintertime, the smoke and smell was so intense that they could hardly stand it, because everybody lived together in the longhouse, all the families, everyone, they would maybe have multiple longhouses, and you had fires down the middle, you know, the ceiling, the example one they have there, the ceiling's maybe 20 feet tall, and it fires down the middle of the longhouse for heat, and then the only chimney was a hole at the top, and so you can imagine how this smoke would disperse before it exited by the chimney. And so I think it was St. John de Brebeuf writing home would say, you know, they would go in the wintertime, it would get so intolerable inside that you would go outside and you would stay outside until you got so cold you couldn't take it anymore, and you go back inside to where your eyes were burning with the smoke again. And many of these men came from noble or well-to-do families in France. They left behind a comfortable life and undertook really severe trials. You know, it's a common thing, I think, among some of the North American missionaries, there were no comforts. You know, once you went out there, none of the comforts that you were accustomed to having, there was none. And you might have a companion with you, but other than that, also probably great loneliness. You weren't getting letters from home until you could see the ship. Once things froze up, probably, you know, months on end that you would see a letter if you happened to be in Quebec, or if they happened to get it from Quebec to you. You know, just tremendous, tremendous sacrifice and endurance. And I think it's a good example for us. We'll talk a little bit about that, you know, that endurance that they exemplified. Because we should remember that they were saints, but they were men too. Just like us, they had families and they had emotions and they got lonely and they got frustrated. One of Saint Noel Chabanel, who we'll talk about in a minute, he hated it. He really, really struggled. He was not adaptable to the other saints. Some of them were, you know, St. John de Brebeuf was known to be very, very tough, very well built, but he was not adaptable to the circumstances. He just detested it, detested everything about it, to the point that he made a vow to remain, because the pull to go back to France was so strong. But it was sacrifice, he made a vow to remain. And his endurance earned him the crown of a martyr in heaven for all of eternity. So the St. John de Brebeuf, alongside him, as we mentioned, St. Gregory Lalemant suffered. And he was born in Paris in 1610. He was delicate by nature. So different, St. John de Brebeuf was very robust. And he had a sensitive appreciation for the finer things of life, none of which he would find in New France. You know, something else interesting, these men were very cultured, Jesuits at the time, at least, very highly educated. And in their spare time, I don't know how they pulled this off, I guess it wasn't spare time, they probably made it a priority, and they they drew books of botany. One of them, I can't remember which one it was, but he classified and drew and wrote about the new species of plant that the Europeans were unfamiliar with. And he was writing works of biology while he was there as well. So just a huge breadth. Saint Jean de Brebeuf wrote a grammar of the language of the Indians he's working with. So really tremendous exercise of charity. St. Charles Garnier was shot with a musket, and he was finally killed with a hatchet while administering to his people in their last moments during an Iroquois attack. And a few extra slides here, but St. Noel Chabanel was killed by a Huron apostate out of hatred for the faith. He was 36 years old. And as I mentioned, he was the one who really, really struggled, you know, went through spiritual dryness and et cetera. They all had their struggles, but really, he really had some difficulty there. So that's just a very brief surface touch on the lives of these saints and on their martyrdom. And there's a lot of good information out there. And the Jesuits, they had to write home back to their superiors about what they were doing, etc. And so we have a really interesting wealth of information. You want something interesting to read, the Jesuit relations, you know, all the letters of St. Jean de Brebeuf back to France, describing what it was like, describing the difficulties that they faced. So very unforgiving conditions and so forth. And so, you know, Father had mentioned to me, Father Benedict mentioned to me, people might be a little bit interested in what's going on now in Canada. And, you know, Father said, I'm carrying on the work. I wouldn't quite take that privilege of carrying on the work, but I'm definitely working in the same area. And so we're going to give you a little picture here of Martyr's Shrine, what it's like today, and a little bit about what's going on in the Canadian setting today. So this is in Midland, Ontario. This is the Shrine to the Martyrs, the beautiful church, beautiful shrine. This is the skull, or half of the skull, of St. Jean de Brebeuf. So this is the largest relic of the martyrs that is housed there in Ontario. I like to pray here. This is kind of one of my missions is another 4 hours, 3 hours, 2.5 hours north of here. And so if I have time when I'm traveling, I can take a half hour detour and stop in. And I like to pray there, to think these men were working in the same place I am, different people, but the same area. This is 2.5 hours away from where I live. So I like to go there and ask them for their help in our work, because we have become somewhat, again, of a missionary country, although in a different way. So you get an image there. Something else neat, too, when you kneel here, you can kneel about 3 feet away from the edge of the reliquary where this is housed. And so looking at his skull, you really notice it's a real human being, you know? He had a brain just like we do in that skull. And they were just like us, but they did God's will extraordinarily well. They cooperated with God's grace extraordinarily well. And just like us, many of their steps to sanctity were day-to-day things. You know, they had to, they probably put a lot of effort just into staying alive, you know, and not always preaching, not always saying Mass, but they had a lot of other things as well. And so just like us, their sanctity built up by little things day-to-day. So the village of St. Marie among the Hurons, the mission of St. Marie among the Hurons, was constructed by the Jesuits with the Indians and some of the Frenchmen in order to build a safer location for the Hurons and to foster the mission there. And so they've reconstructed the village to the best of their ability on the site where it actually was. It was burned down, if I recall correctly, by the Christians themselves because they fled. They knew they couldn't withstand the attack that was coming, and so they burned the village and fled to Christian Island, which is a short way away, and I think eventually returned to Quebec. But the village, the mission has been reconstructed as best was possible, and so we're just going to flip through here some pictures to give you a sense of what the interior was like, what life might have been like in the village. I'm just going to flip through quickly here. So obviously furs figured very prominently. They were the economy of Canada at that time. The fur trade, the Hudson's Bay Company, basically governed the country for quite a while. They controlled the fur trade and so forth. And so it was the point of contact or the point of beginning for the contact between the Indians and the French, because the furs were very valuable in Europe at the time. So they would trade it for tools or things that they didn't have there. And the Jesuits would travel with the fur traders. So the fur traders would come to Quebec by canoe. They'd take a two-week trip for this particular mission. It was a two-week trip by canoe to Quebec. And then the Jesuits just had to wait there until the fur traders showed up, and see if they could convince them to take them back to where they were from on the canoe. And they, at first, they didn't want to take Saint Jean de Brebeuf because he was so big. He's such a big guy, and they think, we got to paddle this guy all the way back 2 weeks. So eventually, they agreed if he paddled. And they were glad they took him. He could handle a whole, he could portage a whole canoe by himself. So, but talk about endurance in the canoes. They're birch bark canoes. So I don't know if you have birch bark here. Is there birch bark here in Spokane? Not much. Okay. Birch bark, the white birch bark is surrounded by a almost paper-like, heavy paper-like wrapping around it. And so they would peel that and put it on a wooden frame and I think cover it with pitch from one of the trees. And that was their canoes. But if you stepped off the ribbing of the canoe, you could put your foot through it. And so you had to sit really still and, you know, 2 weeks of canoeing there. An example here of the kitchen area. Mrs. Sabella made the picture. I have to thank Sister Noelle, CMD. She put together these slideshows. I just kind of patched them together for the purposes of mine, but she had all these slides and pictures prepared. She had a couple different ones. She's named, her name is after Saint Noelle Chabanel. The chapel here, they've reconstructed the chapel. And so really they've done quite a good job. They have some old vestments there and chalices and so forth, and really neat timber frame buildings. And to think any steel that came, so they had a blacksmith on site, any steel that came, they had to bring by canoe. Imagine bringing bars of steel in your canoe a little bit at a time, couldn't take it all at once. Also animals, if they wanted to bring European animals, they had to bring them by canoe. They had pigs on site from what I remember. So someone must have brought two little piggies in the canoe for a 2 week journey and make it there, you know. This is an example of what they believe was perhaps a canoe lock to bring the canoes in from the river, because this is right, when you're here, you can look out over Georgian Bay. And so they would come 2 weeks up the Ottawa River down Georgian Bay, and they would be at the mission. And so the mission had palisade walls. It also had a stone structure. This is the oldest remaining stone foundations in North America, from what I recall. So you can actually see there the original stone foundations. The full stone walls have been reconstructed for, you know, our viewing, but you can still see the foundations there. And the palisade walls, there's another picture there, the chapel. So palisade walls, they would, you know, strip a tree of its branches, put points on it, and that was used as a guard. The original grave sites here of Saint Jean de Brebeuf and Gregory Lalemant, they had a cemetery for the Christians. So the village was divided. They had a section for the Christians and a section for the non-Christians who were there as well. Here we have an example of the longhouses. This is what the Huron people would live in, so covered with bark and a wood frame structure inside. And that was your habitation all year round. That gives you a picture there of the inside. So you would have some sleeping areas, perhaps along the side, and you have your fireplaces down the middle. I gave my own tour, the tours in recent years, some of the long story, but basically I don't trust the tour guides, you know, and sometimes they're not well edged. They informed us, I learned, the other priests, you probably don't know this, but the sash that we wear is to keep us from working too hard. We learned that from the tour guides. So I was, all this time I thought it kept my cassock on so I didn't get caught in stuff when I was working, but it's actually the opposite. So, yeah. So I gave my own tour to the kids. I've been there many, many times over the years. So but I was given the tour, and in here I was talking and looking at the kids and the sisters that were with me and so forth. And there's these two other people sitting in there. They probably thought I was a tour guide. You know, so they were lucky they got a Catholic version. A few more examples here of some of the housing and so forth. So we'll just flip through quickly. There is a birch bark canoe. There's an example of birch bark canoe. And it gives you a picture here of some of the routes that might take place. So we have they would have come up here from Quebec, down this river here, up the Ottawa River, and then down, and then into Ontario, here or into the Georgian Bay, down Georgian Bay, and then right there was the mission. So a long journey. Now, interestingly, what's going on today in Canada, if we have time to cover that? We have a few minutes left, yes. And so one time I was driving from one mission to another. I thought, okay, I'm going to combine these missions. I'll go straight from Montreal to Sudbury. And so Sudbury, Ontario, is there. Sudbury is a mining town. And so I'm driving and driving. I had started in Quebec City, drove along the St. Lawrence River, stopped in Montreal, had my mission in Montreal, visited people there, And then I drove to Ottawa, then up to Sudbury, and I realized basically the exact route that the missionaries journeyed. We're doing it again. Different circumstances, different reasons. You know, they were looking to convert a pagan nation, and we're looking to convert an apostate nation. Canada had a lot of beautiful Catholic history, both in Quebec and elsewhere. When you travel to Quebec, and I don't know, maybe Bishop Waugh is going to speak a little of this, but when you travel to Quebec, every city, every street almost is named after a saint. Every town is named after a saint. When you fly into Montreal, as I sometimes do, if it's a clear day, the churches are built cruciform in the shape of a cross. And so from the sky, Montreal has all these crosses. Like every two blocks, a church that elsewhere we would look at like a cathedral, just huge. When I say Mass there in Montreal, often we say Mass in what used to be a rectory, and it's now a social services center, and we can rent the greeting hall, and the rectory is big enough for our mission. We could get 50 people in there if we had it crammed. And next door is the church, big, big church. It's been converted into condominiums. And the rectory would have held maybe 20 priests in its day. You figure a population that was almost 100% Catholic and what it must have been like. You know, but the Novus Ordo has done its work well, and Quebec is one of the most secular, is the most secular province in the country. They actually last week banned public prayer. It is illegal. Public prayer is illegal in Quebec. Now, one of the things, there was also Muslim public prayer taking place. So they're pushing, you know, sort of in imitation of France a little bit, pushing for secularism. But that's a little aside from the point. I'll flip through, see a few other things here. These are just some of the other sites. Then we'll tell you a little bit what we're doing today. I think I might have, okay, that looks like our last slide there. So today, I'm located in London, Ontario. And as I mentioned, pointed out there, London, traditional Catholicism was started, you know, just like everywhere else in the world, there was a faithful priest. And there were people here and there who said, something is wrong here. We want the true Catholic faith, etc. In Canada, that priest was Yves Normandin. Father Normandin traveled literally across the country. He would start on the East Coast, travel through the night by bus or plane or whatever worked. Sometimes Mass would be at 2 a.m. at your mission. If that's when he was there and that's when you could have Mass, people would be waiting for Mass. And he basically laid the foundation of all tradition in Canada. I know Bishop Waugh, his family, I believe, was Father Normandin was very important to them as well. He said the first Mass in my area in 1973. And from there, it was at a house. Then they built a chapel in the house. Then they bought a property and converted the garage into a chapel, a little church. And then about 30 years ago, they bought a church building. And they persevered there for many years. We have that church today, Our Lady of Victory in Ontario. Many of the priests who are here, and the sisters as well, have gone on mission there before. And just like many places, it was a faithful core, a couple main families, some other people, and 25, 30 people through the years. And then in around 2014, things really started to grow. And they've really been growing since. And then came COVID. And is anyone here from California? Okay, we have a table of Californians over there. Okay, and one lonely Californian at the back. So California were our competitors for how severe the laws could be in during COVID. So at one point, we were permitted legally, the law was no more than 5 people for a religious service. And it got to one point where it was illegal to leave your home in Ontario unless it was necessary. So although, interestingly, the police, almost every single police service in Ontario, with one exception, said they would not enforce that law. So they had pushed a little far there. But it was a very, very trying time. We went to very great lengths to make sure the faithful had access to the sacraments. The border was closed, and I'm the only Canadian in this, working with the CMRI, and so that meant I was isolated in that way from the other priests. Thankfully, there was another priest in Quebec at the time we could see once in a while for confessions and so forth. But a very trying time. But it also bore great fruit, because people started to think, started to study. They were locked in their houses, so to speak. And they're wondering, what's going on? Why did the Novus Ordo close before they even had to? The local Novus Ordo closed their doors before it was legally mandatory. People were saying, you know, what about our souls? And so forth. You know, the alcohol stores and the marijuana stores are open. So if you need to sustain an addiction, go for it. But the churches are kind of closed. So if you want to get over an addiction, tough luck, I guess. You know, so it was a really difficult time for myself and for many, many others. But it also bore very good fruit. The church in that after that about tripled in size, parishioner-wise. And we recently bought a school in 2022. We were able to, in December of 2022, one of the mothers, we've been talking about the school for a while, and we were making arrangements for sisters to come, and then COVID came and everything. And one of the mothers texted me a picture of a school for sale, an old country school, and, you know, for almost $1 million. And we're a fairly small parish. So I texted her back something along the line of, haha, wouldn't that be nice? You know? And then in January, the bishop told me sisters were coming. I thought, So we bought the school. And somehow, St. Teresa, there was a talk in St. Teresa, St. Teresa got that school for us. When we have had a great devotion to her, actually kind of neat, the roses. On my ordination, we had yellow and red roses. Me and Father Lee, Father Sanquist were ordained together. And the lady doing the roses was going out the door, and she said, you have to pray, you know, that we get roses, because I want to buy roses, but they're expensive. So we did, prayed to St. Teresa, and she came back, and she was filling the vases with roses, and she wasn't running out. The store gave her double the rose order. So we got literally a shower of roses at her ordination. Couldn't get much closer. So St. Teresa got the school for us. And when we got in there, the walls were painted like a pale yellow and brown, Carmelite colors. Sister's like, who paints their walls that brown, you know? And then the entire carpet in the basement was a pattern of roses. Like, who carpets their basement with a rose rug? So our thanks to St. Teresa for that. We were able to get the school and, you know, make it happen. We have the school there. And we have the CMD sisters are there. Two of the CMD sisters had dual citizenship. So that was wonderful. They're able to travel freely and so forth. We have 38 students this year, and we just took on our first boarding students. So we have a couple students from the Philippines. Their parents are here somewhere today. So that's an exciting new development for us. And then you'll meet Bishop Hua a little later on, and I think you'll hear more of his story probably when he's here. But we've got to know him over the last few years. I traveled to Quebec, where he's been traveling a long time. And so we both kind of cooperate there for the good of the faithful. So they get Mass every 2 or 3 weeks up in Quebec. And then we have missions in Toronto, every Sunday missions in Toronto. And so two Masses in London, Mass in Toronto. Then we travel to Sudbury, Ontario, and likewise to Quebec on a regular basis. And then some of the priests from here, actually, from the City of Mary, travel up to Calgary, Alberta, and also to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. So there's a lot going on and, you know, working towards that. So we appreciate your prayers for our efforts there. We tried to buy a bigger church the other day, and I called the bishop, but he said he didn't have $1.5 million. Said, but it's Canadian dollars, so it's actually only 1.2. How about that? So if anyone's got, you know, if your back's hurting because your wallet's too thick, if there's 1.2 million in there that you forgot, you know, why see a chiropractor when you could give away all your money? I'm just kidding. Not God's will yet. We don't need it yet. So very good. I think we're right around time there. Is that any quick questions? We have 1 or 2 minutes. Any quick questions of interest about Canada or the martyrs or anything along that line? We don't need any, but that's okay. All right, one there, yes. In Montreal, yes. I say Mass in Montreal every 6 weeks, and also Monsignor Wah. And they may be going up to every other Sunday next May, April or May or so. So we have Mass there in Montreal or in Longueuil, which if Bishop Wah was here, he would tell me I just brutally mispronounced, but I'm trying. And so there's Mass there on the North or South Shore. Yes, so there's Mass regularly in Montreal. Has a degree in history, is a school teacher, taught in the Catholic system, Novus Ordo system for a year and then couldn't take it. Became traditional, and so he's scheduled for ordination hopefully next spring. He'll be receiving the diaconate in December, and then hopefully next spring. And we have two more men in the seminary right now. And so, you know, God willing, maybe God's got big plans, because we could certainly, a lot of work for all those men. So it's good to see. Okay, all right, well, I think I'll leave it there. Thank you, very enjoyable audience. And